park right across the street.
Well, that would be a neat occasion, because I remember from the very first little hole in the wall we had is the Sierra Club office, which is really Bill Zimmerman, the trustees for conservation. That was all we had and shared with the Citizens Committee on Natural Resources.
Right.
Just two people and one secretary, and it's grown.
Yeah, now we have 9 full-time lobbyists and a total staff of almost 20, including interns and support staff in Washington, and one of the powers. But the important part of our Washington, D.C. office is that it is the base for our grassroots. Well, as you know, we have a lobby week almost every week with from half a dozen to 50 volunteers who fly in from all over the country, and then from our base on Capitol Hill fan out to the congressmen and senators' offices. Nobody else does that as regularly and as routinely and as effectively as the club.
Well, that's because they haven't followed the club idea. They haven't lost their tax status yet.
Well,
the other organizations need to do that.
I think there's something else as well, though. As problematic as it is, David, I think the strength of our organization is in its disaggregation. You know, the fact that we have a board of directors that is elected from the membership. Well, the Wilderness Society and Audubon Society don't have that. They have self-perpetuating boards of people from either the political elite or the social elite or the professional elite. And what that means in organizations like that, I serve on a board of trustees of such an organization, is that it is much more staff dominated, and thus its soul and its imagination is limited to that can be done by a few staff people. Whereas the clubs has imagination and initiative that bubbles up from 8,000 different officers of the club in all of our chapters and groups. And this disaggregation brings with it all sorts of problems. You know, there's a whole lot greater potential for disagreement and lack of coordinated effort, and that sort of sometimes duplication, sometimes counter threads to our effort. And I don't think any other organization has the guts or the, from their perspective, the luxury of accepting the messiness of our outfit in order to get its strengths.
Well, I think we can accept that messiness because we spend a lot of time out of doors. I don't know whether any other organization has as many people who spend as many man and woman hours outside. And wilderness is saved from outside as well as inside. You have the inside battle, but if you know it, you're going to fight for it.
I've just been living the last 3 months of my life, 3 weeks of my life, together with our department heads in the room right next door here, building our budget for next year. And as we look at numbers and line items and things like that, the outdoors disappears.
Cause, you got to get out of here.
Absolutely, absolutely got to get out of here. And I was so disappointed because, as I chatted with you last, I had an outing scheduled with Jack Davis, the superintendent of Kings Canyon Sequoia, to get up to Muir Pass to rebuild Muir Hut, which was built by the club in 1930-31, and has a leaking roof and that sort of thing. So the morning of the day I was to leave, the budget was still in a shambles, and I simply had to cancel that trip. Damn it. But George Winsley, our outings director, went and said it was just a stupendous rebuild for him. I missed it.
One of the things that you might try doing when you're in San Francisco is have some meetings over, say, at a little restaurant in Sausalito and ride the ferry over and back. Have you tried that?
Yes. Yeah.
And I haven't done that nearly often enough. We're in the front deck and let the wind blow through you. That it does just what Johnny was saying, the wind would do, it blows away cares. And it,
my wife Jane and I, there's an inn, the West Point Inn.
Still.
Where it's still up there. We ought to have our board retreats in a place like that where you must walk a mile to 2 miles in order to get in or to get onto a ferry boat and sense the outdoors.
Yeah. And that is still, I think, one of the great virtues the Sierra Club had from the beginning and still has.
Get outside and know.
People get out.
I had a letter from somebody who said in Southern California he's setting up a kind of a rump group, Sierra Clubbers for Pete Wilson, now that the Sierra Club has endorsed Wilson's opponent for Senate. And while it was a relatively aggressive letter, he ended with magic words. He said, "I'll see you in the mountains." Now that tells me that this fellow has got the movement in his soul, even though his political instincts are just slightly awry.
So much of my time. Doug's time, Joanne's time, Mary's time, President, Executive Committee's time, internal.
Go ahead. Why don't you look at David and start?
So much of our time and attention goes to administering and worrying about the latest Internal Revenue Service audit, which was just completed today, regulations dealing with the unrelated business income tax, decisions as to what kinds of advertisements we ought to accept and not accept in Sierra, and what the ad edit ratio ought to be, all these sorts of internal conflict resolution or administrative matters divert our attention from worrying about the ozone layer, the greenhouse effect, being effective strategists and outspoken, outraged, effective benders of public policy dealing with rainforests, etc. One tends to lose a bit of perspective. I must admit I was thrilled today. Driving into work, I heard the Sierra Club mentioned twice on the radio. Once was because we had prevailed in a lawsuit against Union Oil for routine and regular pollution of San Francisco Bay. Major victory, terrific case. And the other was a local Sierra Club chapter spokesman nominating the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors for Governmental Trickster of the Year because of a proposed decision on a solid waste dump that they were about to make, saying that he would withdraw his nomination if they made a different decision on a solid waste dump. Well, that's the wonderful side of the Sierra Club, because we have so many people out there who don't have to give a damn about the unrelated business income tax or whether the development department is making a mailing at the same time as the books department. I mean, you know, that sort of stuff is internal static in the administration of the organization. But we need people who are outdoors.
What you need here on the wall in the library, I guess, is a widescreen television with beautiful mountain scenes going on, and the music of rivers and birds and so on, so you'll think you're out there.
You know, this isn't just a problem for us. As you know, I used to be executive director of the California Coastal Commission, and our commissioners met every 2 weeks. Statewide commissioners met every 2 weeks for 3 days at a time, dealing with real live development issues. Are we going to fill this wetland? Are we going to provide public access to this beach? Are we going to allow a major hotel to beetle over the bluff and dominate this state beach? All of those decisions were made in rooms which had no windows, usually public meeting rooms, far from the coast. Yeah. And the essence of the
discussion. No ties, no jacket, whatever you want. Just for being comfortable outdoors, so that you remember what we're about.
That's an idea, all right.
I think there'd be quite a kick. You'd get quite a fashion show. And then video it.
One off, though. Once it starts. But not everybody in the building wears a tie, of course, as you know. We kind of pretend to be outdoors.
But it's like the reverse of that. In the old Sierra Club annual dinners, people would go black tie. Uh-huh. So everybody, no one would recognize anybody in
That's
the black
right.
tie. So that was part, was just about as if you were in camouflage.
80% of them were rented black ties.
Tales
of it, you're right. But just the objective is, hey, remember who we are. In tangible ways, little ways, amusing ways, big ways. And
all right, then I'll go on.
Sure.
Get some Japanese to build you a waterfall down in the lobby. Have you seen these Japanese waterfalls in various cities in Japan?
Yes.
They fooled me. I would have to go and look down to see, well, this is on a stream, or they just fake it. They did such a beautiful job.
Okay, fellas, you can get up and leave.
Okay. All right. John told the Germans in a fight to save Redwoods as a national park.
The idea of a national park in the Redwoods really was either dormant or non-existent for many years. During the early efforts at preservation of the Redwoods, we're going back into the 1920s and before that. The Sempervirens Club had created a state park, what became a state park, a big basin. They were people from San Jose, and I believe that park goes back to the year 1902, not as big as it became later, but that's when it originated. Then came the Save the Redwoods League in the early 1920s, formed by people who saw a need for preserving the northern Redwoods or some vestiges of them because they were being logged very heavily at that time. And so the Save the Redwoods League was created by a number of very deeply concerned people, most of them quite well off, who contributed their own fortunes into buying up land that had virgin redwoods on it, buying it back from the logging companies, which essentially had stolen it from the public domain in the first place by the fraudulent device of homesteading claims and things like that, which they would obtain in large numbers from just anyone who came along and then buy them back and take the trees. So to get the redwoods back into the public domain, those properties had to be bought by the people who wanted to save the trees from the companies which owned them and which set the price on them that they wanted to get. And there wasn't any way to force them to return these trees to the public domain. So the Save the Redwoods League obtained land by getting donations, offering the donors to have their names placed on various groves within these parks as the money was donated, names of themselves or an ancestor or memorials to members of the family who might pass on. They could name the groves for whatever they wanted and have a bronze plate put on there in return for donating money to the league, which was using the money to buy up various stands of redwoods, mainly on the Eel River in northwestern California and on the Smith River. During World War II, the National Tribute Grove, tribute to the men fallen in battle, was created, and that of course had a popular appeal, and people who had lost members of their family in the war, I believe, were attracted to donate to that particular park, which became inspired to donate to the park that became Jedediah Smith Redwoods State Park on the Smith River. So those were the two largest parks in the northern redwoods, the Humboldt Redwoods on the Eel River and the Jedediah Smith on the Smith River, and then there was another called Prairie Creek Redwoods State Park in between those two, which had a substantial amount of virgin redwood forest on it, on this Prairie Creek, which was a tributary of Redwood Creek. Then we began to look into the possibility of a national park, because state parks could not be created rapidly enough and in large enough acreages to save enough of a forest to be truly representative of what the redwoods had once been.
Let's wait for this plane to pass over.
Okay, let her rip, John.
Tell me...
get your head down here by the lens, too.
You know, what you wanted to do, basically, with the national park, and who you had to fight in order to do it.
All right. Ready?
Okay.
We had the Redwood State Parks up in the northwestern corner of California, which were mainly the result of the efforts of the Save the Redwoods League. And we had kind of ignored the idea of a national park that would bring all of the remaining large redwoods together into something that would really endure. But in about 1959, we began to realize that there wasn't going to be enough left with these little patches of a few thousand acres each, which were state parks. So the idea of a Redwood National Park was revived. It had existed in previous years, but never had amounted to much. So we got very seriously interested and concerned with having a real national park in the virgin redwoods. And there weren't many virgin redwoods left, many places where we could do that. Redwood Creek was obviously the best place, the place that had the greatest remaining stand in one piece, where there was a substantial stream, and of course it was fairly close to the ocean, so the idea was that eventually this Redwood National Park would take in a representative stretch of the coastline as well. This coastline is so intimately entangled with redwood forests, you might say. The idea of a Redwood National Park then came into being and was mainly pushed by the Sierra Club. The Save the Redwoods League was not on board at the beginning because they had their own program going, and in fact they developed a kind of a competition in a way in which the league felt that the Sierra Club was stepping on its toes and was trying to put a national park into a place that the league had no particular ambition to preserve. And therefore there was a schism, the Save the Redwoods League versus the Sierra Club and its adherents, and unfortunately there was some bad feeling. Eventually, though, after a lot of wrangling, during which many redwoods were lost by logging during the time that passed, Congress passed a bill creating the Redwood National Park in Redwood Creek, which is where it should have been, but meanwhile, a lot of the trees had been cut down. Large areas had been clear cut. Then later in 1978, Congress passed another bill enlarging the Redwood National Park to take in the areas that should have been in it in the first place. But by then, those trees were gone. Most of those areas had been cut. However, the enlargement created a buffer zone in which new forest can grow to protect the remaining old growth that was in the original park that was created back in the 60s.
Okay, let me change this thing. Let it rip.
Shall I have John up in the air now?
No, 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 that's actually good. If you look at his eyes, perfect, that's great. You want to wait for that plane, Peter?
Okay. This yellow jacket is bound and determined to give Mark.
Oh, I don't care. He can't hurt me. Just a little thing. Okay, I think I know a little bit more what you want, John.
Yeah, just to say that the redwoods were in danger and you felt you needed to preserve them, kind of what happened, but not as much into this.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay.
We had a string of state parks protecting groves of redwoods, largely because of the efforts of the Save the Redwoods League, but anyone who would look at the redwood country and see how rapidly the trees were being destroyed and hauled away knew that something more had to be done if a representative example of that forest were to survive. And so the idea of a national park in the redwoods was born, and we began working for that. And various groups got together and finally joined in. A lot of time was wasted in trying to determine where the park should be. But I believe in the Sierra Club, we knew from the start that Redwood Creek was our last great chance to get a Redwood National Park that was really worthy of the name. So we worked in that direction, made a lot of trips to Washington, D.C., talked to congressmen, talked to senators, the Secretary of the Interior, and worked on the press. We even got the United Auto Workers to take a strong stand endorsing the Save the Redwoods in the new Redwood National Park, and the most unlikely group, some of them, came into the fray and joined the movement, and we had a national park in the making. We finally got various congressmen to introduce bills to create a Redwood National Park, generally in the area that we were hoping for, but always somewhat smaller, because they were listening to the loggers who knew that the park was coming, but were doing everything they could to hurt it and to make all the money out of it that they could. In other words, they sold land into the Redwood National Park for as much money per acre as they would have gotten if they had kept it and sold the logs. In other words, they cut the logs and sold them, and then sold the land remaining for as much as they would have gotten when it had its forest on it. So the logging companies came out ahead no matter what. They still got the logs and they still got the land, and most of that was before we could actually get the park established. Once we got it established, we had saved a pitiful 7,800 acres of virgin redwoods, less than half of the amount of virgin acreage that existed in each of several state parks in the redwoods. So the national park did not save very many virgin redwoods at the time, but there was hope that the forest could be restored and that the land that we had saved, along with the state parks that did save substantial areas of redwoods, would someday come into a great complex that would eventually be a restored redwood forest of large trees. And we also had some coastline, some pastures, the stump land that I mentioned, highways and everything else in the park. It was a compromise, but it gradually became a worthy national park. It was enlarged again in 1978. Very few virgin redwoods were left to add at that time, but we added a buffer zone which would protect the virgin groves where the tallest trees in the world were along Redwood Creek for the future. That meant that we could reestablish forest and other ground cover so that erosion would not destroy those few groves that we had saved down in the flats along Redwood Creek. And today, the damage is not undone, but at least it's stopped. And the Redwood Creek drainage is protected. Not all of it's in the park, but there are easements and so forth which are saving the virgin redwoods of Redwood National Park. And if we had never obtained a national park there, those trees would be gone today, along with the tallest trees in the world, which were included along Redwood Creek.
Let's stop for a second. Okay, back, Peter.
Yeah.
That's good. And let her rip.
Just tell me the first part, Martin. That's all I use in this angle, just what was happening to the redwoods.
We thought the redwoods, or some of the redwoods, were secure because we had state parks there, and then began to realize as we watched the speed and the progress of the logging in the redwood country that the great mass of the forest would soon be gone. Redwoods would become a thing of the past, at least as far as large areas of forest were concerned. So it became obvious that a national park had to come into existence. It was the only way to save the redwoods, the remaining redwoods, or some of them. We would never get all of them because the redwoods were too scattered for that. We saw the redwoods going down before these chainsaws, and we knew that something had to come about. Something had to happen to save the vestige groves that remained, or future generations would have nothing to look at in order to interpret what kind of a land we had once had. So the idea of a national park was born. Redwood Creek was the obvious choice of a place for this park, and that's what we went after. We went to Congress.
Okay, now back up with that.
Yeah, you got.
You're gonna have to. You're gonna have to go with the sun.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
Let's just do the one middle part once more. You just that we saw that the redwoods were going.
Yeah.
Carol, back up away so you can creep it into the sun as the sun moves.
Messages, because that was really, really good.
It's gonna move really fast.
We'll try to make that a little more sensible.
Okay,
there you go.
Still rolling. And
what I want you to do is just kind of create for us this sense of alarm that you have, that these redwoods are going fast. We got to do something now to protect them from the chainsaw.
As it moves, you
want me to back up more now?
Yeah, because see, the sun's moving, so you're going to have to be like into the sun there. That's good.
Well, you're out of it now. You got to come. Okay.
Okay, it just should be real short, Martin.
The redwoods were going fast. We hadn't realized how fast, but the chainsaws were ripping right through the forest and just mowing them down. We had some state parks, but we knew the only way to save a representative forest of redwoods was with a national park. And therefore, we went after a national park. And meanwhile, all the time that we were doing that, the redwoods continued to fall. It was like watching a giant lawnmower go over the land.
Plane to go over.
Great.
Okay.
Take two.
Okay, one more try.
That's much better, Carolyn.
Give us another sense of that sense of alarm. They were going fast. They were getting mowed down by the chainsaw.
Suddenly we realized that despite the fact that there were state parks in the redwoods, the vast remaining forest wasn't as vast as it had been. The redwoods were being mowed down as if a giant lawnmower was going over the entire region. The chainsaws were ripping through the remaining forests, and we knew there would soon be nothing left worthy of a redwood forest's name. So a national park was obviously the only answer, and we had to work for it. We went to Congress, we went to all of the strong groups, including labor unions, anyone else we thought might take the slightest interest in saving the redwoods in a national park. While we were doing that, the loggers cut faster than ever because they wanted to prevent the formation of a redwood national park. And despite that, the park was secured, but it took years, and we didn't save what we should have saved, small acreage compared even to some of the state parks. But it was a nucleus. It gave us a chance to build a border that would eventually become forest again and protect the small but very significant and important groves that we had saved in the original National Park Bill. That included tracts where the tallest trees in the world still stand. Nothing has ever been measured standing any taller than the trees in Redwood National Park, although during the logging, one of the trees that was felled turned out to be longer when it was on the ground than the tallest known redwood, which we found later. So we have a redwood park, and we hope it'll endure. I think the Park Service is doing the best they can with that piecemeal park that we were able to create out of the remainder of the once vast redwood forest.
That's great. So I want you to tell me what you remember of Brower's role in this one and how you and he worked together on the struggle.
In the Redwoods, Dave Brower was inspired and inspiring as always.
Could you start that again?
Okay.
Have a good
look. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
In the Redwood fight, Dave Brower was inspired and inspiring, as usual, and he got very involved in it. Ed Wayburn, the president of the club, once in a while through that period, was extremely heavily involved. And Dave took up the cudgel and designed advertisements which went into the newspapers across the country, telling the president that just endorsing a Redwood National Park was not enough. It had to be the right park in the right place. And that was our issue, to get a real Redwood National Park and not just some little token tract that would tie in with state parks and be called a national park. We wanted a real park. So Dave would set up meetings with the Secretary of the Interior, who was Stuart Udall at that time. And several of us, it seemed to me, we went once or twice a week back to Washington to descend upon the Secretary and impose our views on him so that the Redwood National Park would really amount to something. And what we were pushing for was something... Well, Dave set up meetings, as only he could, with the Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall at that time, and other people, office holders in Washington. And several of us, including myself, Ed Wayburn, the president of the club, Will Seary, and sometimes even Francis Farquhar, was sort of the patron saint of the Sierra Club at that time, and we would make these flights back to Washington over and over again. It seems that we went every week or so during the heat of the battle to impose our feelings on the Secretary and have him move to our side, which he hadn't really been on to begin with. He was listening to other forces that were trying to get a Redwood National Park that would be too small and in the wrong place. So we would make these trips, and one thing I remember was that sometimes members of our legislature, the California legislature and other office holders in California, would go along too. But Dave would only set up the trip for the Sierra Club, and the legislators would have to go on their own. And they were good men, and some of them very good fighters. But I remember that when Dave booked passage for us on the airlines, the Sierra Club people all sat in first class, and the members of the Assembly and the State Senate had to sit back in tourist. And they didn't mind that at all, but it was just a way to show Dave's flair for doing things first class. He always did. When there was a publications committee meeting or anything else, Dave didn't want the Sierra Club to take second place to anyone. So we flew first class. We stayed in the best hotels. That's not why we went, but it just turned out that way. And just one of the little issues I remember, because so many conservation groups are on a shoestring, and so was the Sierra Club then. It had no funds, but it was behaving like a big outfit. I think Dave felt that we could compete better with those we were fighting if we at least fought on their terms and didn't take a back seat even in the embellishments of our everyday travel and other things we did.
Tell me, Martin, just about your writing articles. Just sort of tell me about how you were in the travel editor or something. Start out saying that, but you felt that this was something that was compelling. You had to do these articles for the Sierra Club, and so you had to do them under some pen names.
Well, I was travel editor of the Sierra Club. Cut that. I was travel editor of Sunset Magazine, and the reason I got interested in the Redwoods and concerned about them was that I went up there to do an ordinary tourist article in the Redwood region, and I saw how badly it was being abused. So at Sunset, I had to wear the Sunset hat, as they say, and I couldn't be involved in controversy, although I'm afraid I was a little bit controversial. And I began publishing articles in Sunset, which were ostensibly about touring in the Redwoods, but I was always careful to get in. I found that in my how to do it, Sunset style, objective, touristy articles, conservation of the Redwoods was creeping in, whether I liked it or whether anyone liked it or not. You couldn't visit the Redwood country without being just destroyed by what was going on there. Let me say that again. Ready?
Look at John.
I felt that even as a tourist, you could not visit the Redwood country and have your eyes open and not feel just totally devastated by what was going on there. And so the problems intruded into my writing, and I got them into my photographs too, of the logging, the highway building, all the destructive practices that were ruining the redwoods. But when I went outside in writing for the Sierra Club or newspapers on that subject, which was no longer tourism, it was concern, I had to use pen names because I couldn't have my name identified with those things while I was travel editor of Sunset. So I had a couple of pen names which I used at various times in the Sierra Club. One of them was Clyde Thomas, my father's first two names. Another was Homer Gaskey, and we said Gaskey for Gaskey, which is the name of a little village up in the heart of the Redwoods on the Smith River. I don't know where I got Homer. And then Dave Vandemark, who was a hard worker for saving the Redwoods and was in our team for sure, he liked that name so well that he began calling himself Homer Gaskey some of the time too, so we kind of shared one of these pseudonyms. Tell me to make it shorter next time.
Did he ever ask you, inquire as to who these guys were?
Answer that to John.
Clyde Thomas. I think people began to know who Clyde Thomas was. I'm not sure they ever figured out Homer Gaskey. I had to do a bit of writing, and quite a bit of writing, in Sierra Club publications, namely the magazine, which was then called the Sierra Club Bulletin. And the name Clyde Thomas would appear on the pictures and on the color illustrations in the books and in various places in the Sierra Club, so I guess it wasn't any worse than any other pseudonym or nom de plume that anyone uses.
Did the publisher of Sunset ever catch on to this and come down on you a little bit?
Bill Lane, the publisher of Sunset, is a very conscientious man, and he was very troubled. He had a split concern. First, that we were all straightforward business people, and that's the way we should behave, and yet at the same time he realized what was happening to California and to the Redwoods, and he knew what I was doing all along. In fact, I used a Sunset airplane at Sunset's expense to do a lot of this. And Bill knew, but as long as it stayed rather sub rosa, he managed to look the other way. However, it was because of a disagreement with Bill over the Redwood National Park that I left Sunset in a high dudgeon at one point.
Wait for the chat.
That's enough. I
want to
let you down.
You did great.
I'm not doing
you did great, Mark. I've got
Ann Brower, when she was Ann Huss, babysat for me. She and my mother worked together at the admissions office at the University of California at Berkeley. And so I've known Dave since I was born, shortly thereafter. We were neighbors in Berkeley, still are for that matter. And I went to school with his kids, although I'm a year or two older than Ken, so we weren't fast friends as children, although we were acquaintances and we'd see one another at Christmas parties and things like that. At one of those Christmas parties in 1964, I was chatting with Dave, and he, just in the middle of the conversation, said, "You have a rather nice speaking voice. Would you come narrate the soundtrack of a film for us about Glen Canyon?" And I said, "I would be delighted to try." I was bowled over. Had no warning. I mean, this was just a surprise. As you have undoubtedly found out, he does things like this once in a while, makes a snap decisions. I went and read the script for Phil Pennington's slide movie. It was all stills projected on some specially lighted sort of a screen and then filmed, I think maybe from behind, on 16mm film, and they could pan and zoom and you almost get the illusion of movement in the picture. It was a Requiem to Glen Canyon and a call to arms to save Grand Canyon. And soon after that, I went to Glen Canyon, what was left of Glen Canyon, in the spring of 65 on a trip with Dick Norgaard and Phil Hyde and Dave Bone and all the Browers, I think, except maybe John, run by Lou Elliott. And I forget, there were 30 or 40 people there. And we saw the cathedral in the desert, and we saw the Escalante. The Colorado, the main stem of the Colorado, was pretty well underwater by then. And after supper, Dave gave a couple of pep talks about how we mustn't let this happen to Grand Canyon, and it was a terribly moving experience and inspiring and so forth. And I thought then that if there were any way I could help in this general effort at conservation, it would be a wonderful way to spend a lifetime. So soon after that, in June of 65, I went into the Peace Corps, which I had planned for some time before, and went to Turkey and spent 2 years in eastern Turkey, northeastern Turkey, doing what they called rural community development, and came back and spent 4 months working for Head Start as a grant analyst, so-called, in the San Francisco Western Regional Headquarters. And then on the I called Dave one day in behalf of a friend at Head Start who was a photographer, who I thought was quite a talented photographer, myself being an expert judge of such things, of course, and asked Dave if he would be willing to look at this fellow's pictures. This guy at the time, and it may still be the case, thought that the ultimate achievement for a landscape photographer would be to have the Sierra Club publish a book using his photographs. So it took a while. I wound up going up to Dave's house one night, and by coincidence, Norman Clyde was there. Norman Clyde having been the greatest of the Sierra mountaineers who began bagging peaks in about 1910 or 12 or so, and wound up being the first one to climb more than 100 peaks in the Sierra. Norman had come to town for an operation on his eye, one or both of his eyes, I guess cataracts or something, and he was 83, I believe, at the time. And so I went up to the Brower's house, and Norman regaled us with stories of his famous exploits and rescues and so forth in the Sierra. And well into the evening, he said, "Dave, when are you going to publish my book?" They had talked about publishing a collection of his magazine articles and essays and so forth that he had written over the years. And Dave said, "Well, it sort of depends on whether I can persuade Tom here to come to work and put the book together." And this time I really was flabbergasted, but it took me a few seconds to say I would love to give it a try. And that's where it began.
Tell me about, just kind of summarize for me some of the early fights in Friends of the Earth. That you were the editor of Not Men Apart through 15 years or so?
Yeah, I started off as second in command. Hugh Nash was the first editor of Not Man Apart. He had been editor of the Sierra Club Bulletin. And we started Not Man Apart, Friends of the Earth started in July of 69. And we started NMA in December of 70. And Hugh stayed for about 6 months or so, he said, until he was sure that the others of us could handle it. And then he moved up to the country and came in once a week or so. And I stayed on until January of 86 with a year and a half off, as 6 months on sabbatical in New Zealand and a year as executive director in 77-78, which didn't agree with me, and I went back to the paper. Well, the first big public battle that we got into was an interesting sort of thing. It was to save wolves and other wild fur-bearing animals. And it was started by a woman named Joan McIntyre, who was the second employee in the San Francisco office. And she came upon an ingenious publicity stunt, which was to put together a committee of socialites in San Francisco who would renounce wild fur coats and stoles and so forth. And she recruited them simply by going through the society pages of the Chronicle every day for a few weeks and noting down the names that appeared the most often. And then she got on the telephone and called them up out of the blue, said, "Mrs. Roth, how would you like to lead a fashion revolution?" this was a hard question to turn down, and she put together a committee of six or eight movers and shakers of the San Francisco society scene, Mrs. William Roth and the wife of the man who was heir to the Hams beer fortune, and I forget who all else. The leading model, one of the leading models in San Francisco at the time, was named Mimi London, and she was on the committee. And they held a press conference in our office at the firehouse, where they announced that they were leading a fashion revolution, that they would no longer wear the skin or fur or feathers of wild or endangered animals. Well, Women's Wear Daily ran the story big. It was in the Tokyo something or other, Asahi Shimbun. It was in the, it was all over the place. It was big news everywhere. And the fur industry was quite clearly scared by this. And it brought in some members. I mean, it was a wonderful stunt. And it arguably helped lead to some legislation, I don't know. I mean, it never traced out the physical impact of it, the tangible impact of it. But it was fun, it was good press, and so forth.
Can I, sure. Just because I can't, you know, we can be so, it's a whole hour on day, we just can't get into a lot of the details.
Right.
If you could just summarize, just, you know, sort of even list off a few of the other things that you worked on, and then just kind of talk just a little bit about Dave's style of leadership and being Friends of the Earth and kind of getting people to do things.
All right.
Okay.
Well, the early battles included this, the Wild Fur Campaign, the SST, where we eventually persuaded Congress not to subsidize Boeing to build the supersonic transports. We were deep into the California Water Project, which continues to this day, but the Peripheral Canal has not yet been built. The Alaska Pipeline case came along early spring of 1970. There were lots of others I can't remember. Dave rallied the troops. He had been the point man in the Grand Canyon in lobbying and testifying in Washington. By the time Friends of the Earth came around, he did less of that. He still did a good deal of it, but he was more a field marshal. Go around, inspire people, keep them going, think up new stunts, newspaper ads to get issues before the public and to build up membership. Speeches all over the place. I don't know if it would be physically possible to count up the hundreds and thousands of speeches that he's given through that time. The sermon, various takeoffs on the sermon, he called it. inspiring people, students more often than not, probably. Bringing in waves of volunteers to work on various legislative and political campaigns through that time. Keep the heat on.
Did he give people a fair amount of flexibility to kind of go and do their own thing in these things, or did he try to interfere a lot in the day-to-day workings of?
No, he's the laissez-faire manager of all time. He would spot people with some talent, he thought, or people would come to him and impress him with their ability, and he would encourage them, and you would be off on your own. I mean, my own experience, first of all, being recruited to do that soundtrack for the film just on 10 minutes conversation was one example of his snap decision in that sort of thing. But Not Man Apart was undoubtedly the most independent of the organizational publications in conservation, and probably almost anywhere. We had no editorial committee. We had no, he would occasionally come in and make our lives miserable by asking us to add something to an issue that was already in bed or close to being put to bed. But he never demanded to read copy before it was published or anything like that. We had a completely free hand. I mean, occasionally if you would mess up, if you would make a big mistake and embarrass yourselves or embarrass the organization, then that's the downside. That's the risk of that sort of